So impact factor, and this is on tape, right? Okay, impact factors. I would say one of the most controversial areas in scientific publishing, not only in nursing, but in academia and libraries in general, is this notion of impact factor. And I'll give you just a little bit, like a thumbnail of the historical background to this. There was a time in nursing when very few people, even professors, very few people were publishing at all. And now we've moved to a point where lots of people publish, and they publish good stuff. And there was a time where one article was a good thing to get out there. And anywhere. Publish it anywhere, anywhere, anywhere. And whether it's a long article, a short article, whether it's in a peer-reviewed journal or it's in a non-peer-reviewed journal, it doesn't really matter. Just publish something, publish anything. And I can remember like a long time ago when I first started in this, not in nursing, but in a business school, not McGill's business school, a department chair begging one of their professors, who is an amazing teacher and a great person out in the field who did marketing work, please publish something, publish anything, we need some publications out of our department this year. And people sort of caught on that if you have an article out there, if an article to submit, there's a journal out there for you. And so then everybody's CVs started having more publications on them. The only problem was that some were really great, you know, sort of really good articles, and some were articles that weren't so great. And frankly, the folks, if you were just doing a count of the number of articles on the CV, well, you know, you would be best to submit as many articles as possible to journals that weren't very selective in the way they went about choosing articles. So what's happened over the last decades, because everybody's competing more and everybody's publishing more, that folks have been looking out for a way to gauge journals. That, yes, we're all equal, we're all good, all ideas are tested in the court of scientific opinion, but there might be some journals that are better than others. And the idea of impact factor came around. What can we calculate, or what can somebody with a big database calculate relatively easily that would give us insight into how good the journal is? Now, I mentioned the very first idea that I mentioned in the presentation. Why do we write in the peer-reviewed press? To communicate and to be part of a dialogue. Okay, let's put on our thinking caps. How would we measure whether articles in a journal contribute to part of a dialogue? Well, we look to see how many times, perhaps, an average article in that journal was cited by other researchers in the future to extend their work, was seen as a legitimate authority for given statements or an inspiration for future research. And in theory, a journal whose articles are regularly cited more often would, in theory, be a more prestigious venue than others. So, now, especially for people who their bosses every year look, how many articles did you publish in 2013 and how good were they and what was your Now, in a lot of cases, they don't only want to see the reference to the article, they want to see the impact factor for the journal. And the impact factor is calculated by, it's a copyright around it, there's a whole business around what they call bibliometrics, which is the science of publishing productivity and grading the impact of various pieces of work on the field as a whole. So there's a company out there that calculates every year the number of times the average article in a journal is published, and now sometimes people are asked to actually put that on their CVs, and they write that in their statements. I publish in high-impact journals. Now, the catch is that there's a lot of ways, there's a lot of things that impact factor doesn't capture. Okay? And I say this because I have been a co-author on some of the most cited papers in nursing and related areas, and I also have articles that I'm very proud of that have only been cited a handful of times. And so I see the benefits, the pluses, and the minuses. But basically, the idea of impact factor is that some journals are more worth publishing in than others. That journals that have higher impact factors, when libraries have to make decisions about what journals will be renewed from year to year to year, sometimes one of the things they will look at is where that journal falls in the sense of impact factors. Now, like I said, fields are different, and the average nursing journal, like I said, the big impact scientific journals and general medical interest journals like JAMA, New England Journal, and the biologically oriented ones like Cell and Nature, the impact factors 20, 30, 40. Now, is it fair to judge an individual article that a reviewer of a CV or somebody reading a statement may never have seen that journal, may never have seen that article, and to give extra prestige to a really bad article that may appear in a journal that has high average impacts? That's a question. But you need to know that this is some of what goes on. And I've, you know, if you're interested, I can pass over to Antonia. Lori Gottlieb, who is the editor-in-chief, as I mentioned, at CJNR for 20 years, she and I wrote an editorial about this, sort of weighing things, because it really is a debate. And it's a fascinating little piece of sociology of science and sociology of higher education, the way all of this goes. Basically, people are looking for an easy way of judging others' contributions to the field and other people's performance. Those measures they're coming up with, like impact factor, are incomplete, and you could even argue sometimes illogical, but it's part of the reality that you deal with. And if, and I know most of you, are working with professors for whom their scientific output counts, they will be thinking, at least in the back of their minds, what are the better impact journals that they can be publishing in. Like I said, most a good impact factor in nursing for a nursing journal is about 1 to 2. Most of the journals fall in that range. But, and we could go into much, much more depth, and maybe you can ask me more questions about it. Does that generally square with what you know or help you understand? So that's the reason why JAMA gets 2,000 to 3,000 submissions a year, because everybody is hoping to get into a top impact factor journal. But and those top impact factor journals get a lot more manuscripts, and therefore they're a lot more selective about what they take. So they tend to have low acceptance rates. And in general, the journals, the articles in those issues tend to get read more often. And people will sort of perk up more. And I'm sure maybe some of the journals that you're reading for your study, that you're looking at for either your lit reviews or your methods sections or whatever, they're journals that are on the upper end of the impact factor thing. But I can almost guarantee you that some of the articles that you're looking at that were very useful to you don't have very high impact, didn't appear in a very high impact factor journal at all. Okay. So the format of a research paper, you know this already. I'm not going to go over this in any depth, but I'll give you some tips. Some tips about the sections of an article and what I see as an editor and a reviewer when I'm looking at articles and we're getting them ready. So the introduction and the research questions. Okay, the typical rookie mistake: too long. That's the usually that really most journals, nursing research, Western Journal, RINA, they want to see 4 or 5 short paragraphs at the most. They don't want you to go back to the beginning of time. They want you to zoom in on what specific question you're asking. Other journals are a little more flexible. But the literature that you present is supposed to lead logically to the question that you asked. That argumentation needs to be really quick, really fast. If you are talking about depression, social support, and multiple sclerosis, let's say, to pick an area out, then probably one of your introduction paragraphs is going to be about depression. Probably one will be about social support, or maybe those two will be wrapped together, and there's going to be something perhaps at the beginning about multiple sclerosis. It would be unusual, the title of your article, not to see some of those themes that are in the title of the article show up in that introductory section. That's a section that you will almost inevitably wind up shortening over time as you edit. Methods. Methods is the easiest section to write. The articles that I've been involved in writing, what are the best strategies to actually launch instead of fail to launch? Start by writing the methods. Tip. Because you know what you did. You know who you interviewed. You know what tools you used. You know what analysis method you used. And the results usually, or might be slightly tougher, but they're usually also not too difficult to write. And the method section and the results section have to fit perfectly together. They really need to work well together. And those are the ones where, as long as you have the message, and sometimes even before you have the message, but you just know the results that you have to put out there, you will be able to write these sections relatively easily. One area that people tend to have issues with, data analysis strategies. As you know, because a lot of you probably wrestled when you were doing your proposals, What and often this is the weakest, the most poorly done of the sections in a student paper, and I can tell you also in manuscripts that are submitted. The analysis that you pursued in exploring your data, the reader of a research article doesn't really care about in most cases. They want to know what analysis you did to the results that are actually going to show up in the next section. It's kind of like a preview. The data analysis strategies is a preview that you should be presenting stuff in the next, you should be anticipating for the reader what they're going to see in terms of your descriptive tables. You describe the sample and then you pursued regressions, or you did thematic analysis, or you had that sample, you described the sample with descriptive statistics, and then you did work to establish the themes or whatever. And after reading that, the reader should be ready to see description of the sample and themes. Not rocket science, but makes it way easier for the reader. Make life easy for your reader. Your first readers or your peer reviewers, they're busy people. There can be cranky people having bad hair days. If you have to make them guess what it is they're going to see, they're not going to be well disposed. Results, of course, what the answers were obtained to each of the research questions. And that's another thing. So these first, I'm saying the methods and the results have to connect closely. The research questions need to appear really closely in the results. That somebody jumping through your article and wanting to know what you found, reading your abstract and going from your introduction and your aim to your results, should see that connection really clearly. You'd be amazed how many times there's one set of research questions and then the results seem to speak to something totally different. Make sure that's not you. The discussion, of course, putting the answers to the questions into context, the expected and the unexpected. So you can't talk about everything that you saw in your data, but you can. That's where the message really comes out. When I was a master's student many years ago, when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, I thought I wanted to be a researcher. So I'd read the middle parts with the methods and the analysis and so forth. A lot of my classmates said, I just read the introduction and the discussion. I don't read that middle part at all. That's great. There are people who are only going to read your discussion. So you want to make sure that you pull out the most important, most significant messages, and that you pare it down to the most important things to say about your paper. Another really, really, really important rule, you're going to see this semester as you work through with your committee. They're going to push back on you when you do this. That nothing should appear, no new results that you haven't already presented in the results section generally should appear in the discussion section. Then in terms of those conventions, what we went out to do, what we did data collection-wise, what we found and what it means, you're supposed to keep those boundaries relatively clear. What a lot of people do in initial drafts, and it's something you have to work out over the course of revising your article, is, you know, I have this results section, but I'm going to shove in these things that didn't seem to fit with the tables and stuff that I put in the results section, but I'm going to get it into the discussion. Now, there is an exception to this, and that's when, you know, you're talking about limitations and possible critiques of what you do and things that you use to check and information that sort of confirms certain things or whatever. But in general, no new data should appear in the discussion. It should all, the meat of what you found needs to all be in the results section. And there are researchers, there are peer reviewers that will go crazy, and they'll be very angry and they'll write really nasty things if they see you mixing results and discussion together. It will happen in your first drafts, not a problem, but you need to fix it before you submit it. All right. And stay within the page limits, which is often very tough. And I know, because I've been dealing with authors. I've been one of these authors myself. I've been saying, but I really need 25 pages. And they say, no, you get 20. But I really need 20 pages. My article is special. It was harder to do. It's qualitative research. I have quotes from respondents, and they're so beautiful. And if I cut from this, you'll never get the richness and the thickness of the description, and the readers will be deprived forever, ever of the richness of what I portrayed. And the editors have to be cold and hard and say, no, you get 20 pages and only 20 pages, just like everybody else. And it can be hard sometimes, but there is always room to cut. There is always room. All right, my number one writing tip, use outlines. If you're writing in IMRAD format, introduction methods results, then the outline, start with what are the 4 or 5 points that you're going to raise in your introduction. What is the lead sentence in each paragraph going to be? Can you condense down the point of your introduction to four sentences? Because if you can't, the odds are you're going to write off the top of your head and hope that eventually you're going to come back. And this is tight writing in a tight amount of space, and you need to be very, very focused. In the research question, that's usually pretty definite, but you should probably have a tick list and let that bit by bit, bird by bird approach. You go through and you write something for each section and until you have a complete first draft, and that complete first draft is probably about 60 to 70% of the work. Once you get a complete draft, you are so far down the path you would not believe it. Working from an outline, and if you choose to use an alternative format, like, for instance, if you choose to take your study findings and you go to a practice-based journal that doesn't necessarily want to see introduction methods, results, and discussion, you go to, like, a journal that publishes, you know, top 5 tips to work with population X, or, you know, how to have the orientation program that's everybody's dream and retains 100% of new graduates or whatever, you go for that approach. It's even more important to develop your outline and what you want to say paragraph to paragraph so that you can see the logical sequence and write around those things so the connections are well done. It's said that these days, between texts and emails, a good writer used to be somebody who, like, sort of the best writers these days are often, most of what they're writing is one sentence at a time, like a really well-crafted sentence. An article is a sequence of paragraphs, and the ability to develop an idea smoothly over the course of sentences, paragraphs, and sections, that takes some work, and it takes some time to develop. But if you don't even know where you're going in terms of the sequence of ideas within sections, it's going to be really hard to get that part done. And I have to say that almost every writing project that I've had, and I'm into the many dozens of articles and book chapters now. Every time I don't do an outline, I regret it and have to go back. Take it or leave it as advice. Number 2 is practice makes perfect. So you got to get in there, roll up your sleeves, get that first draft out. Go through the process with an article, and hopefully it hasn't been a traumatic and demeaning experience, and you want to try it again, do try it again, because I will promise you 100% it is easier the second time, even if you switch kinds of articles that you're writing. Your first article is an IMRAD format article, the next one is an opinion piece or a lit review or whatever. They are masterable skills. None of us comes out of the womb able to write perfectly formed articles in the first draft. You learn this over time. It's a skill. And some people would argue that any advanced practice nurse, nurse leader, nurse educator, and of course any academic or researcher must develop this skill. It's a communication skill. So be patient with yourself, devote enough time to it, and be steady about the way you work through it, and find, you know, celebrate, you know, break open the bottle of, you know, your favorite soft drink when you get that acceptance email. Celebrate it, but jump back in. Jump back in, because it really does get easier over time. There was another point that I was going to raise with that. But anyway, the best way to learn is to see how others do it and practice it. What you will see, when I first got into graduate school, I used to be awestruck by everything that I would pick up. I would think, wow, these are such cool ideas. This is so neat. This is so amazing. These people are so creative. And then the pendulum swung when I started to study research methods in a lot more detail and started to get the red pen slashing through my work and so forth, and started to know what research articles are supposed to look like, or what the logical flow of ideas is supposed to look like. And now for me, the pendulum has swung back to the middle. Nothing is perfect. There are structures and so forth that make life easier on everybody. Well-organized prose is so, it's not easy to write, but it really is a contribution to an overall dialogue, and we need to, and we really, we need to master those skills and practice them over time. So what I was saying, though, about the individual sentences and the paragraphs and so forth, it's not easy. The patience that people have now, in all likelihood, readers of articles today, they're going to pull a PDF of your article up, and they're going to scan through, and they're going to look for individual sentences that give them pieces of information that they want. But some will and should really read through the whole thing for the flow of your argument. There are some really amazing authors out there. You should try to learn from them as you go along. And realize that sometimes reading things and sort of scratching your head and saying, how did that make it through peer review? That means that you're developing your sophistication around this. So let's talk about peer review. Beloved and hated, I have to say. Like, it's one of these things. It's like death, taxes, whatever. We've decided that peer review is what we're going to use to make sure that what appears in the literature is as solid and reliable and not dangerous as possible, and that we're actually moving the dialogue forward. So when we talk about journals, a peer-reviewed journal is that the editor or editorial staff consults external experts to evaluate the material under consideration from the journal. And this is contrasted with non-peer-reviewed venues where basically the editor and or the staff make all these decisions on their own. That they sort of sit and they say, okay, good enough, not good enough. Maybe they do the red pen thing and they go through. But the idea of peer review is that there's external vetting of this. And there are actually standards. There's associations of peer-reviewed journal editors. We have one in nursing, and it always cracks me up. It's called INANE, the International Association of Nursing Editors. And I'm not sure whether they understood the irony or not, and I'm not sure what's more scary, that they didn't understand the irony or that they did. But in any case, there's another International Association of Medical Journal Editors, and it's medical and biomedical and related journals. But basically, everybody pretty much understands what peer review is, that there is something going on in terms of the content being reviewed verified by others before it appears in the pages of the journal, that in theory will make people who read those articles more confident about what they see there. The peer reviewers are normally subject matter experts and or experts in the research or scholarly methods that were used by the authors. The truth of the matter is that you just never know who you're going to get. There are journals that have, most journals have blinded peer review to at least some extent. I know when you did research methods, you talked about single blind versus double blind and so forth. At least one kind of journal blinds, most of the time, the peer reviewers, the authors of an article are blinded to who's reviewed the article. So, and basically the reason for that is that the authors don't know who's done the peer review of their article, to avoid authors retaliating against the peer reviewers or their institutions when the comments aren't so favorable. So we're trying to establish a little bit of independence. Most journals blind the authors of the article. The reviewers don't know who wrote the paper and who submitted it. Truth be told, it is amazing how many times someone in a field can figure out through the back door who actually wrote the article, or at least who the lead of the team was, because they know some things about what was said about the setting for the study, what was the approach that was used, the other articles cited, or whatever. Sometimes we even try and blind the editors are the only one, even the editors don't know when they're making decisions about the identities of any of these people. But the idea is that word vetting, that idea of examining and verifying thumbs up versus thumbs down and identifying what could be made stronger about a paper, that's supposed to give us a better quality literature than we would normally get. Whether we actually believe it gives us a better quality literature is open to question, but that's the process that we have in place. And what people often say is, it's not a perfect process, but we really don't have anything else out there to do this. And there are problems sometimes that emerge. The basic process is that you send a manuscript in, and that there is something that goes on at the editorial office, sometimes by someone who isn't a researcher at all, who's just a sort of a management, administrative, clerical kind of person. Often, though, it will also be someone who's an editor or a managing editor and somebody who actually knows about the content. And they will look. They'll do a quality check, and they'll do a little bit of an internal review to say, okay, is this in the ballpark at all? Is this something we could ever see publishing? Assuming, of course, that the peer review says it's okay and the authors are capable of raising the quality of what's submitted. And sometimes they will, like I was mentioning before, they will, at that point, they will say, you know what? We're rejecting this without review. We're going to give you a chance to submit to another journal that's a better fit for you because we just don't see we don't see that this is going to make it with us. And sometimes you get a very good explanation, and sometimes it's like, no thanks. We get many, many submissions, and we can't review everything, and so that's it. Once the article is determined to be in play, you know, a potential article for a journal, it's sent to two or three, or sometimes more, external reviewers that are chosen by the person at the editorial office who's going to get these back and then make a decision about the article's fate, its disposition or whatever. And the reviewers sit and they assess the strengths and weaknesses and they draft a written commentary about the strengths and weaknesses. Now, many journals have a list of questions that they specifically ask. Is this new? Were the methods valid? Was relevant literature cited? Sometimes they ask those questions as yes, no questions and please add comments. Sometimes our journal, CJNR, we have a lot of researchers and authors from different career stages. We have a template that has lots of questions that people can elaborate on. I've done hundreds of these in my career, so now I know exactly what I want to write in a review, and I basically, sort of start head to toe introduction through. I have a general conclusion about where I'm going in terms of whether I think this is strong, whether strengths outweigh the weaknesses of the article, and then I go through the things that I think should influence the decision about whether to accept or not, and then talk about things that I think could be improved in future versions of the work. Reviewers often disagree among themselves about what the strengths and the weaknesses of the article are, and what would improve the article. But sometimes they agree perfectly. And the dream situation for the editor is they get an article on a good topic. The peer reviewers say, thumbs up. Great question, great methods, solid results, tight connections between the results and the discussion. We'll make an important contribution to the field. And all three reviewers say, thumbs up, thumbs up, thumbs up. And then they say, the handling editor takes it all under consideration and says, I read it too, and I say, accept as is. In my 20 years in the field, I've heard about a grand total of one article ever, personally, in terms of somebody I know ever having accept as is for a research article. Okay? That's not the norm. Sometimes we get to that category of rejections where either it's so what, this article makes no contribution to the literature, it's just too far out there, it's not going to make it in another go-round, or there is just gigantic problems with what the authors have done in the article. And if even one of the reviewers points these out and the editor agrees, then it's reject. Then it's flat out reject. Try again with another journal. Here are some comments that may help you redraft your article for the next journal you submit to. And maybe when you have your dream list of 10 journals with your top one being number one, maybe it means that you go to number three or number four or whatever and you try again. And there's a whole bunch of strategy around this stuff. If it's really important, you rack up the publications for your group. Some authors literally take the manuscript that's been rejected and they do minor touch-ups to, any spelling errors, grammar errors, or whatever. They change to the new journal format and they just send in exactly that form. And sometimes the same peer reviewers are contacted by the next journal and see the same article coming back without anything done to it. Not favorable at all. Not a good way to go. Everybody's a critic, like I said, and sometimes it's not very fun to get feedback. I would say sometimes reviewers are wrong. Sometimes they're just wrong. They didn't read your introduction properly. They don't understand your research question. They don't understand your methods. They think they know more than they do, and their comments are out to lunch. But most of the time, there's something in there that can be used. And it's your job, if you really want to get contribute to the dialogue and you want to really contribute to the literature, you need to take that feedback to heart. Most, I would say, about 80% of peer reviewers, about 10% of 20% of peer reviewers, they're overwhelmed. They take on peer review because they don't know how to say no. And they do it at the last minute, and they're doing it really quickly, and they say, I like it or I hate it. Terrible paper. Looks like a master's project. Period. You know, don't accept. Don't accept under any circumstances. But most reviewers, they actually try to help you make the manuscript better. And I'm going to talk about the three kinds of reviewers that you may meet in your journeys. This is a big effort. This whole peer review process is a big effort, and it is generally very clear that while you may approach many journals at the beginning to say, would you be interested in a piece about needs of caregivers of ovarian cancer patients in stage four or whatever, you can send to multiple journals and see what comes back. You're really only allowed to submit an article for consideration to one journal at a time. Because what can happen sometimes is that people are tripping over each other. The editorial office and the peer reviewers are working really hard on this, and then the article is accepted in more than one place at once. The instinct to do this, to submit to more than one journal at once, can be, I don't have the time to wait around for this. If this process takes 3 months on average, and I got to publish, and my bosses are crawling anyway, they're really anxious, and they're giving me a rough time. I got to get it out, and I got to I got to work around this process. But I'll tell you, nothing will destroy your credibility with a journal editor more than if they find out that you have submitted the same manuscript to more than one journal at once. This is an unbreakable rule, okay? So if you do this and bad things happen, it's not because I didn't tell you about it. The most common outcome is revise and resubmit, where you're told, we read your article, we see strengths, we'd like to see it in our journal potentially, but we need you to do some things for us. We need you to respond to comments that the reviewers came back with, and maybe even some comments we came up in the editorial office with, like please trim 4 pages. And basically, revise and resubmit. You go back up to step one with a revised article, and you do one or sometimes two modified go-arounds. Sometimes, if the suggestions are relatively concrete, I need to know response rate, or you need to put response rate for this, or you need to give some characteristics of your subjects, or you need to talk more about your theme development and validation and so forth. Sometimes, the editors will say, you know what, I can read. I can read what they did, and I can read the cover letter of the resubmission, and they did what we asked for, and it's ready to go, and I don't need to go back to the peer reviewers. Sometimes they'll send the revision along with whatever comments you have back to the peer reviewers. I would say if you're aiming for the right journals, this should be happening about 60 to 70% of the time for you. You should be getting this revise and resubmit. So that's the desirable state, that you're in the zone, that you've gotten the peer reviewers and the editor interested in enough in your article to see it go further. So let's talk about the three kinds of reviewers. There's one kind that for the journal, it's a so-so kind of reviewer, but they're the experts out there that don't have a lot of patience. You know, they read a lot of stuff, they're busy, and they try and be the sage or the diviner. They try and be counselor to the editorial office. Is this article any good? I like it, I don't. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Will this article reflect well on the journal? Does this article contribute something new to the discourse? And these people often are experts in the area, and they will know exactly what's been published in the area, and they'll know that if you've published things before, they'll pick out if there's an article, if you've been salami slicing, and what I mean by, you know what I mean by salami slicing? You take the same study and you cut small pieces so you can get 3 articles instead of one out of the article. They'll pick up on this, they'll pick up if there are things that make them suspicious about the article, but basically they'll be going for thumbs up or thumbs down. The other another category is the reviewer as goalie. And they're willing to get more into the details of why they did or they didn't like your article, but basically they see themselves as the guardian of what gets to be in the literature and who gets to put extra lines on their CV or what goes into good journals. So, you know, you can either look at like soccer goalie, you could look at Red Rover, you know, any of you play that game as kids, where they're looking to find all the problems in your article. So the goalie wants to keep the bar for publication high. They want to keep you honest. They want to make sure that you report the way you're supposed to report, that you really follow APA format or whatever the format is, that you provide honest and balanced reporting of results. This is the first study ever to do X. No. It's not the first study ever to do this. Or no, that's not right. Or that's not what you found. And that you properly referenced other scholars' work. They're the ones who are there checking, looking for the mistakes that you've made. And they see their job as keeping bad stuff out of the literature. I would say some reviewers overdo this role. They go crazy with it. And their stance at the beginning when they get the article to review is, I'm going to find the things that are going to torpedo this article and make sure that it doesn't wind up in this journal. Not many, but some. These folks, though, can give you really useful information sometimes that you would have never known about otherwise. And sometimes people who have just finished a master's or a PhD, or they've suffered and they're going to make other people suffer too. Sometimes late career folks, these young researchers today, they just don't know how to do research properly, and they got to. Sometimes it can be overdone. The role that I like to see and the kind of reviewer that you want to make fall in love with your paper is the coach reviewer. And the coach basically is trying to help the author and the journal make decisions so that the best version of your work possible gets into the literature and helps extend the dialogue and inform practice. And they offer specific and detailed feedback about how to make this come about, including when it's just, you know, you're submitting this to the premier qualitative research journal in the world, and this manuscript is your first shot at this, and you didn't do some of the things that are typical of this. I think this is good. Here's some feedback, but I think this is where you ought to go instead, versus inadequate analysis, lack of theoretical grounding for your study or whatever. Now, peer reviewers, whether they're coaches or diviners or goalies, they're really, really important to journals. And they do this work for free. Because in the end, the journal reputation or standing, whether we're talking about impact factor, whether we're talking about the reputation that a journal has out in the field, whether a professor or an instructor who's making up a reading list for her class or his class will use articles from this journal, or whether they think, ooh, not great, this is not going to be good examples for my students, it relates to the quality of the manuscripts that are published. And the editors and the peer reviewers come together and they influence the quality of what actually winds up in the pages of the journal. And getting good manuscripts submitted and getting good reviewers, it's sort of all of a piece. So most journals take very careful care of their peer reviewers, try to give them feedback about what's useful about their reviews, but they take the reviews seriously. And you need to know that. Because there can be an instinct, and I'm not saying you guys because you're not part of this millennial generation, most of you, but there can be this, well, you don't like it, that's just your opinion. And it's not like that. This is one of those instances like having a graduate supervisor where, you know what, you need to smile and you say, thank you for that feedback. I think there's something useful for me to take in this. So what you should know about peer review. Reviewers are normally published authors in your area. Sometimes if you're in an obscure area, it may be just somebody who's known as an expert to make sure that the things you're saying about the population or the context are relevant. You need to assume the best of their ability to provide some meaningful feedback instead of saying that you think that they're, you know, poorly informed, lazy, or mean, frustrated, taking their anger out on you. You need to assume that there's something to take out of them. Reviewers have heavy demands on their time. So when you submit stuff that's really rough around the edges, sentences that are incomplete, things that don't follow normal conventions, stuff that's really difficult to follow, you're going to have somebody that might fall in love with your paper and they're just going to say, nah. I'm not even going to bother writing you a review that will actually help you make the paper better. The last point, most editors will take peer reviewers' feedback very seriously. The editor is where the handling editor or the editor-in-chief, depending if like what the structure is like. I'll tell you about what we do at CJNR now. But that's where the buck stops. Ultimately, I make the call on whether a particular article gets accepted or not. But I take those peer reviewers very seriously because you know what? They look to see what ultimately gets into the journal down the line. And if they see that their comments were disregarded, they're totally, and that the paper was weak and doesn't speak well for the journal, they're not very happy about contributing peer review in the future. So we keep in mind that sometimes peer reviewers write nasty things, and we try as best we can to take out hurtful discourse, things like lazy, inadequate, pointless, things like that are just hurtful. Sometimes some frustration creeps into the reviews. Generally, like I said, some of the reviews that you get back may have a harsh tone, but the overall intention is to help you make the work better. So resubmission, that should be your goal. You should not, so if somebody's telling you, your boss is telling you, you need to have a manuscript on your, accepted for publication on your CV within 3 months, you need to tell her, I don't think I can do that, because the average peer review process at a journal takes 3 or more months. But in any case, what you should be aiming for is that they like your article enough to want you to review it, to revise it in some very focused ways. Most resubmissions should be accompanied by a letter that details point by point the critiques and responses. So you will get, normally, back from the editor of the journal, you'll get reviewer number one and pretty much the verbatim of what they typed into the manuscript submission form, and they will list what they thought were the strengths and the weaknesses. And you should go through those comments one by one and number them. Sample unclear, or need to state time frame for sampling, or need to articulate this, or clarify this wording, or consider changing the use of this term, or whatever. You need to make a list. And I would say some of the best ways to do this is just to make a table, to have one column be comments, another column to be responses, so that the editor and the reviewers, if we go back to them, can say, okay, this is what they did with each of the pieces of feedback that they gave. If it's favorable feedback, I loved this, or I found this particularly innovative, it can go into the table with, thank you very much, the response, thank you very much for this kind flattery or whatever. But in general, they want to see the things that they were suggesting be modified. Now, one of the things to keep in mind, you do not have to incorporate all changes suggested. But you do have to own up to the critiques in some way and articulate why you're not choosing something. Sometimes they will say, well, why didn't you consider variable X? Well, because we didn't measure it in this study. But then you need to think, okay, is there a way I could incorporate that critique in the discussion, in the strengths and weaknesses section or directions for future research? And then you can write, no consideration of variable X. Okay, lines added in discussion. Thank you for this useful feedback. We hadn't thought of that. We've added these lines in the discussion. But to submit a manuscript back after revision without a clear sense of what you've done to change it and incorporate the feedback is to make the editors and the reviewers throw their hands up and to question whether or not you really used the feedback at all. Okay, that's a really, really important thing. Another point, revise and resubmit, I would say in all nursing journals and most journals in other fields, is a very hopeful message back from an editor saying, we like you. We like your paper. We really want to publish this. Help us out. So get in there, make the changes, and get it back with a nice, thorough letter, and you will be usually very pleasantly surprised. Now, in order to just give you a complete picture of this, I've been involved with a doctoral student that I co-supervised. And we have been with, and it's a complicated article, mixed methods, based on her dissertation, which she defended 3 years ago. And we have been more than a year and 5 revise and resubmit cycles with a particular journal. It's long. But they like the study. They really like the study. And it was a very complicated study. This is the 99.99999% tale of experiences. 5, this is the most I've ever seen. And I have to say that the people I'm working with, including the former student, they're saying, this is a little over the top, don't you think? And I said, but they really, really like it. And this is a new kind of research to try to report this way. In almost all cases, one revise and resubmit will do it, and you'll be in. So move fast, be thorough, show that you followed up. Questions?
Yes.
No. Sometimes they're the same, sometimes they're not. In my experience, the first preference, when I see somebody as an editor, when I see a revise and resubmit come in, I see the resubmitted manuscript and the cover letter, I take a first look and I say, and I read the letter, the cover letter, and I look at the manuscript and I see, did they really try to come to grips with the critiques? Have they done what they can? And sometimes I say, you know what? I think it's beyond my expertise in terms of deciding whether or not they've really dealt with this. And then I'll go back to the original reviewers. But because the idea of peer review is that a peer review journal is that it's not just Sean's journal and Sean gets to say what goes in and goes out, I always want feedback on what's going on. So if I can't get the original reviewers, I'll bring in others sometimes. And I have to say, we're pretty sure that different reviewers have come in over the course of those 5 revisions. 5 is weird, okay? It's just weird. Most journals, if they know that it's 5, it falls into the just not ready, just not close enough category. But they liked some things about this article, so. All right. Often journals will have a drop-dead period, and they'll say if we don't hear from you within 90 days, we will assume that you don't want to resubmit, okay? So it's not like that offer is forever. And sometimes journals change editors and so forth, and they will consider, if you go back to them, too long after you get those reviews back, they'll say, submit a brand new manuscript. So it's a two-way street. There's a little bit of a deal that the editors are making with you. If you submit something back that deals with the points that we raised, we are willing to very strongly consider your article, but part of the condition is you got to do it quick. Okay. Some other points. When your manuscript has been accepted, hooray, you break out the bottle of Diet Mountain Dew and you pass around the cups among your editorial team. You now can have it go from the section of your CV or resume marked in preparation article, your publications in preparation. It can move from there to in review and the name of the journal. It can be a little dangerous sometimes to say in review at JAMA, for instance, given that your odds of acceptance are 5% or less. To in press, you can call it in press now. You can call it that category, put it in that category. Now, if you're going to put on your CV, just a word to the wise, save that email message that says that it's been accepted, because in press means that it's been accepted. After it's been accepted, it can appear on the journal's website and in print, if the journal's still doing a print version, anywhere from 1 week to 1 year or more. It really depends on the journal. Some people say that an indicator of the quality of a journal and its process is the speed with which an article moves through the different parts of the process, how fast the peer review process is, how fast the acceptance happens, and how fast it actually appears out there once it's out there. There are fields in biomedical science where there are developments happening fast, 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 fast. And not only do people need to keep a critical mass of publications up on their CVs, but sometimes they risk their results becoming irrelevant or being outweighed by other people's work or outdated. Not so much the case in nursing. Generally speaking, it's a good idea to take note if your colleagues are saying that a particular journal has a bad track record, it's 2 years, and that they accepted this article and it still hasn't appeared yet. But you also need to be reasonable. Journals, and I'm going to talk about this in a minute, they're generally volunteer operations, or at least the editorial office side of things. Our editorial operations, we're always trying to make the processes better, get you better, more useful peer reviews, be fairer and so forth. But sometimes a week is just not realistic, even though you may need that line on your CV to say that it's actually been published, because some bosses will only count the article if they actually have the PDF in their hands. Some will say accepted with a confirming email is good enough. You will usually receive, this is a word to the wise, before you get to the point of it appearing on the journal's website or in the print version, you'll usually receive copy edits. So pre-typesetting things where a copy editor goes through line by line and makes sure that you followed APA format as the journal uses it. That you have, that your language, your spelling, like let's say you go to a UK journal, the spelling is slightly different than you'd see in a Canadian journal or an American journal, and so they make all those edits and they go through and they edit for consistency, and some of the sentences and so forth that slip through before in your rewrites and the peer reviewer's feedback get fixed. And they'll usually ask you to approve of any changes they've made. And then sometimes there'll be an extra step where they send it out to an electronic publishing outfit and they'll take that Word document and they'll prepare a mock-up of what's actually going to be the PDF. And then you have another chance to fix typographical errors and to add in information and things like your current address or contact information, the primary contact for people interested in the article or whatever. You should take this feedback very seriously. Most copy edits are intended to bring the piece in line with the journal style. So this is definitely a time where you don't want to get too belligerent with the journal's editorial staff and say, no, every character, every period, every comma is exactly where I want to see it. In general, the comments are valid and or are trying to get the article so that the articles aren't all over the map in terms of how they look within a given journal. But you need to make sure that when people are editing your work and when they've typeset things, especially tables and figures, that they haven't introduced errors into the process. So it may be very tempting in the sea of things that you're dealing with, your family, your friends, your work, all the other stuff that's going on. You get the, you know, approve the manuscript, and it's like, okay, yeah, whatever. You know, it was so long. You guys are so awful for the peer review process. I just want it out. And you sort of say, approved. And then you realize afterwards they spelled your email address wrong. Or they introduce, there's an obvious typo, or the diagram is mislabeled and so forth. And some journals will have corrections and so forth afterwards, but it's always better to fix the stuff up front. That's tail end of stuff. There are journals that edit heavily. One of the best or the worst journals, depending on how you look at it, American Journal of Nursing. I was on their editorial board and I published with the general interest journal. Very few research articles. They edit to death. Even in the last versions, accepted by the peer reviewers and everything, they edit, oh my gosh, to the point that some authors say, no. No, not doing it, never publishing, not publishing this one, and never submitting anything to you again. And there are other journals that are fairly light. I have to say at CJNR, we have really good copy editors, but sometimes there are little fisticuffs that go on, you know, no, I don't want to change this. No, I don't think that's a better word than this word. I want this to appear as it is. And you know, basically you have to decide what you're willing to fight about and what you will let go. All right. So that's sort of the practical stuff. Now I want to talk a little bit about electronic publishing and about CJNR and the time we have left. But do you have questions about some of those practical steps and how peer review works? Anybody ever peer reviewed anything? So, you know, something to keep in mind, you know, you may, especially if you continue your research training, very good exercise. Your supervisor may be asked to review something and they may kick a copy to you. They're usually supposed to advise the editorial office. They may give you a copy and they say, well, what do you think of this? And how would you draft a review to this? And they'll work with you so that you get in the practice of writing a good review, a helpful review. Okay.
Yeah, I suffered a lot. Yeah, but you need to be like very specific for each, like for each command. I try to answer that.
Yes.
And making it out, I putting it like I did that line, this line.
Yes.
In detail.
Absolutely, absolutely. That itemized list of critiques and responses. I can tell you, this will. You will never regret doing this. You will never regret doing this. At one time, it was the A-plus author, the one who is the shoo-shoo of the editor, Willie Wise. Now people expect it. Now people expect that you will do this because they say, I am busy and I don't have the time to wade through your manuscript. And if you don't show me this and if you don't tell me where it is that I need to look, if I want to find it, don't even bother.
So.
Yeah. Generally speaking, I mean, it's an interesting thing, and it's a sort of not particularly relevant to you guys, but I'm not really crazy about peer reviewers who write lots of line-by-line corrections. Like, I like if a peer reviewer will say, you know what, it needs a spell check. But that somebody writes, I kind of liked it, or I kind of didn't like it, but that's not really useful from a scientific point of view what the ideas are, and all they do is point out line-by-line spelling errors or grammatical errors. I think it should be does instead of do, and so forth. If that's the only things they can come up with, we have line editors for that. But you know what? We get all kinds, and we take what we can get. And then the author, who really wants to get their work out in the world, has to work within the system. And working within the system means you give them what they're asking for. Like I said, sometimes you can't necessarily change your manuscript substantially because the study's already been done, or the manuscript, or excuse me, or the reviewers were wrong about something. But you need to figure out a way to negotiate that, to say, ooh, so sorry, I think we left the misimpression that we did X. Actually, we didn't, so what we're doing to change the manuscript to clear up that misunderstanding is this. But usually, I would say, about 80% of the feedback that you get should probably, there should be a change in the manuscript that occurs, even if it's not, you know, exactly what they're asking for. And maybe 20% is explaining what you did so that the reviewers, the editor, can understand better. Absolutely. You agree to disagree, you know, we're taking that into consideration, but often that's what the discussion is great for. If you don't agree with what the reviewer said, or you don't agree that it's an important point to mention, but, you know, you can write something in limitations, you can write something in discussion, some may think that, no, but we could talk about that in another time if you ever are interested in that. So, let's go out and talk about the big picture of scholarly publishing, because this may be some information that may be useful to you. So historically, the system has been based on voluntary labor. So the classic business model of journals has been that free intellectual property, your 632 projects, for instance, which really wasn't free because you paid tuition, you took your time, you did all this stuff, you went through all this process. It's not free, but you're not asking for payment for it. This new content that you generated is vetted by volunteer peer reviewers because 95% of journals do not pay their peer reviewers. And so they're doing it as something good for the field to help the journal put the best stuff possible out there. Yes, some journals pay for reviews. I've been paid for a few reviews. But anyway, and it's overseen by editors. The whole process is sort of refereed by editors who are working on a volunteer basis and are not paid. They bring the whole package of what all those volunteers are doing, your intellectual content, the work of the experts, and the editor, a for-profit publishing company is bringing together and is charging libraries and or subscribers for the privilege of reading. And there was a time where nobody questioned this. They thought, okay, that's just how it goes. It's not that big a deal. And then, frankly, what happened was the business people started thinking about this, and the subscription prices started going up in a big way, and people started saying, if I have published something and I'm in a publicly funded university or we've used public research money for this, shouldn't I, as a member of the general public, have a right, if my tax dollars went into this, to read this, even if I don't have a membership or access to a library that has this? People started to talk about why there's this whole idea with the internet, information should be free. The thing is, there's a cost, right? Your labor is going into the original research, the peer reviewer's time, the editor's time. The system has been, though, that the company takes the risk of putting all this stuff into motion and actually putting out an electronic or a paper journal. The exceptions to for-profit interests being involved, like Elsevier and Lippincott and so forth, have been not-for-profit journals and or journals published by academic departments and associations. So I'm going to talk about CJNR. CJNR has been around for 45 years. It has been published as a public service by Ingram School of Nursing, even before it was Ingram School. The L'Infirmière du Québec, it's the Ordre des Infirmières et Infirmiers, that publishes this, and it's their thing, and they're not trying to make a profit when they put in ads for, you know, nursing abroad, nursing up north, and nursing uniforms and continuing education conferences. They're not trying to make a profit in the end. They're trying to pay for the costs of running their journal and so forth. But basically it's one of the two. It's either an association or an academic department that goes and they try and break even so far. But there are companies out there that are like trying to make a profit off of this. And we could go into a lot of detail, probably not today, about how this goes. Today, people are concerned about the limited access by the public to the fruits of publicly subsidized research. So I don't know if you've ever had the experience of Googling a subject and pulling up an article that comes up in your Google search, Google Scholar or other, and you click on the article and sometimes, ooh, happiness, you get the actual PDF coming up, and sometimes you get a paywall that says, ooh, you can have this article for $25 for 24-hour access. And you say, okay, first thing I'm going to do, www.mcgill.ca library, and I'm going to see if the library has it. And so, just a discouragement. They don't have this journal. So, how much do I need this article? Could I go through the back door? Do I have a friend at U to M who might be able to get me access? Or whatever, and you try your back routes. But some people don't have back routes in. Some people, nurses, professors, or whatever, their libraries don't carry it. They don't have personal subscriptions, and they can't afford $25 every time they see an article that they want. And there are people who are saying, maybe this is not okay, that this is the way the system works. Libraries are faced with exploding costs. Like I said, we're into the tens of thousands of journals out there, and libraries have to choose what they pick up and what they don't. And the for-profit companies especially keep raising their rates, and they do a lot of cross-subsidization. That, and what I mean by that is that there are journals that have very high impact factor, and all the libraries want them. And so now to have a subscription for a library to Cell or Nature or whatever, it's $2,000 and $3,000 and $4,000, and they use those fees to subsidize having other journals at the publishing company that have smaller, and they sort of have sort of a business system robbing Peter to pay Paul and so forth. But the bottom line is that libraries have to decide how they're going to use increasingly tight money to have their body of journals that they give access to their users for. We are also seeing, what I'm going to talk about briefly, something called open access. Have you guys heard about this? Open access journals? I see a few nods. Okay. And other new publishing models, but I can tell you, and I'm going to tell you about open access in a second, it's trying to change that business model, free, 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 and the readers pay. It's trying to change that model, but we still haven't figured it out totally right now. And basically, we're sort of competitors to members to libraries. The author gives away their intellectual property. They get the credit for having a line on their CV that says published in the Journal of Nursing Excellence or whatever, and that's good for them. But other than that, they don't pay for the peer review, they don't pay for the typesetting and the website maintenance and the print costs and so forth. In open access, the authors typically are the ones to pay for an accepted article to appear, and it can be in 2,000 or more. That is a huge deal for somebody who gets offered to do this, not like that. Because now there's a lot of people who are going to be able to do this, and they can get the article out quickly, and they can be submitted there, and they can get the access to it. So some of these journals, the author pays $2,000, and basically almost as soon as it's accepted, it goes through the production process, and anybody in the world with a web connection can get the article, can download that PDF right away. And then there's modified versions, where access can be immediate, for paid users, a library that has the journal. Only those libraries or those individuals that have the paid subscription can get the stuff that's right fresh off the press. And then others have to wait 3 years before it becomes free. And they're basically trying to figure, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, depending on what the shelf life of information in the discipline is and how valuable it is to get the articles that are fresh out of the door, because it's so important to keep on top of what goes on in the field. And it's a little bit of variation of, you can pay $35 for this hot new book coming out this year, Harry Potter 19, or you can wait 3 years and buy it on the remainder table. That's a bad example because J.K. Rowling's still selling the books for high prices. And you can go to the remainder table and you can buy it for $3 3 years later. It's a little bit the same idea. But all of this is still being worked out. And nursing is, I would say, lagging a little bit in this respect. Like, we haven't talked a lot about this. Most of us are still mostly submitting most, you can see all the most in the hedges. Most of us are still submitting most of our articles to regular journals that have business model number one. We submit it for free, sign over the copyright or most of the copyright, and peer reviewers are doing it for free, the editors are doing it for free, and there's a company that's sort of behind things, or there's no company trying to make a profit, but everything's free up until the end point. So this is something to be aware of. If you come to a point, and you may, especially if your co-supervisors or whatever are really
anxious to get some of the products of your 630, 631, 632 project out the door, open access journals may be some of where you might want to publish. Some of them are quite respected. There are some that appear to be scams, frankly, that are operated out of, you know, people's back offices, and they're trying to appeal to the people who are desperate to buff up their CVs. But there are a lot of legitimate ones too. And sometimes, depending on the subject matter and depending on, you know, some of the context areas, this can be, these journals can be a good strategy. And I know people in this community, in the McGill and University of Montreal community, who are publishing in open access journals. Not everything, not all the time, but some selected articles. One of the nice things is that, unlike the regular model, open access journals can often, they often have a little more leeway about how many articles that they can accept at once and how fast the articles can appear in print. And that can be a really nice thing. And in the to compensate for some of these costs and so forth, some people say, well, $2,000, of course they're going to accept anything, and peer review is going to collapse. There's interesting variations that are showing up, that now some journals, both open access and non-open access, are actually putting the peer reviews themselves up on the web. And with the permissions of the peer reviewers, they're putting the signatures of the peer reviewers on the article so that somebody who's reading these articles can see the path that an article went through from original submission through revisions, incorporation of feedback through to acceptance. It's a whole different way of thinking about the process, right? Because originally it was, okay, we polish, finished form goes in, and if you're working in the right institution, you get access to it. This different version of things that, you know, you can, the way information should be processed, maybe it should be a little more of a free flow, shouldn't be so restricted about what winds up getting in or not get in. There should be some feedback, there should be some tightness around the stuff, but mostly we should give the consumers of the information an opportunity to look at whether the peer review was valid and is probably appropriate. The electronic era. So paper journals are becoming increasingly uncommon. Some of the holdouts are going to be journals like the University of Quebec, association journals, and some of the leaders. Like, I think we're going to see, you know, just like they say, the New York Times is going to be the last newspaper in the world to go out of to not do a print version anymore. But more and more every month, people are reading La Presse, they're reading New York Times, they're reading all kinds of newspapers, and they're also reading scientific journals on the web more and more. And if you go to the McGill libraries, you will see that the number of print journals is decreasing every year. So PDFs, as you know, are a very practical way to exchange articles. And, you know, we often, it's so easy, just attach them to an email. But what you have to, I'm just going to put a little piece in here. Even if it seems like it's a free thing just to attach a PDF when somebody asks for it, and it can be somebody who wants to read your work, it can be you sharing journal articles that you have in your personal library with others, it can be really easy to just send those off. What you probably should keep in mind is that it costs something somewhere to produce this, and that libraries, it costs libraries to have these. I'm not saying get obsessed. I'm not saying, you know, sort of wring your hands with moral doubt that you're doing the right thing when you share an article that isn't generally available out there. But I'm just saying give it a little bit of thought, you know, because now you guys are about to be the senior people, some of the senior people with us in the profession, and you're going to be publishing, because all of you are going to be publishing. You should think about some of the economics about this and what it means. You know, it's lovely to say everything should be free, everything should be free, but there are consequences to that, and the question of who pays gets kind of important. Questions about that, or thoughts? Do many of you still print out? I'm an old school guy. I still print out a good chunk of the articles that I pick up in PDF form. Yeah?
I need to write on it.
But now you can annotate. Now you can annotate and so forth, but I'm just not used to. I find an iPad, a tablet, a lot easier to read stuff, and you know, I'm starting to use the annotation software. But I have to say, old school, if it's detailed stuff, I am really going to go through it online. Almost done. Okay, very good. So what you should know, initially publishing in a peer-reviewed venue should be your angle, but you should consider other kinds of publication in the future. Some people, this is where that business of the 6 months in June, and when June comes up and is over, some people think it's an ethical responsibility to put out the fruits of your scientific labor. CJNR. We have offices on the second floor. I'm here in the building. You've probably seen my office. It's Canada's only general interest nursing research journal. We tend to do a lot of Canadian-related content, stuff about native health, rural health, Canadian health and social issues, but we publish across all specialties. We have international and Canadian authors. We've been 45 years in existence. We are, to our knowledge, the only one in Canada that does this. We have been working on partnerships with the Canadian Nurses Association and other groups to try and stay alive. You can read about my role. Things that you should know about us, we mostly right now publish traditional research articles. About 80% of them are qualitative, but I'll tell you, qualitative researchers as peer reviewers are brutal to each other. And they will savage articles. And I can tell you, in the last 5 to 10 years, the number of master's student projects from this, from McGill, that we published is very small. So we're willing to consider anything, but it goes through the regular peer review. We don't have a special path for student papers. And there, we will shortly be introducing a new column called, we call practice-based scholarship, that will be a little bit different than the IMRAD format, but will be much better suited to the kinds of articles that you're often writing in 630. So stay tuned. If you have questions, contact me about this journal, other journals. Thank you very much.